Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, very occasional declutterer.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that features three individuals who share a common love of cinema. We try to show some aspect of that love each week as we discuss the films that we see. And this past week, our movie sojourn involved a trio of films based on characters interacting with communities, some that they were born into and some that they were thrown into with somewhat dire results. First up is Magellan, a film by the Filipino writer-director Lav Diaz about the Portuguese explorer whose 16th century voyage is credited with being the first to circumnavigate the world. Then we'll discuss a couple of more contemporary studies, one being Iris Sack's titled Peter Hujar's Day, and the other, writer-director Charlie Polinger's blend of water polo and social Darwinism titled The Plague. Let's start by turning the clock back a full five centuries. It was in the year 1519 that the Portuguese navigator Ferdinand Magellan, then around 39 years of age, set out as head of a Spanish expedition bound for the Malacca Islands, a part of the Indonesian archipelago that came to be known as the Spice Islands. Filipino writer-director Lav Diaz, whose 2016 film The Woman Who Left won the Golden Lion at the 73rd Venice International Film Festival, tackles the Magellan story, having cast the Mexican actor Gael Garcia Bernal as the title figure. His newest film progresses from the time of Magellan's early seagoing and military experiences to his vain attempts to convince the King of Portugal to finance a voyage, then his successful wooing of the Spanish king, the voyage itself, and his final doomed attempts to convert resistant Filipino tribes to his brand of Christianity. Diaz plays fast and loose with chronology, not to mention history. He fills scene after scene with lavish visuals, and he includes a few dreamlike sequences in his trademark languid-paced, some would say lethargic, style of filmmaking. It's harder to understand, though, beyond the obvious, just what his portrait of Magellan is trying to say.
Well, before we get into that, I want to give a little more context around the writer-director Lav Diaz, because I don't think he's a household name here or even in the Philippines necessarily. He's part of a growing movement that is known as slow cinema, which tends to be quiet, contemplative, long, and, true to its name, slow-moving. Filmmakers like Bela Tarr, Andrei Tarkovsky, Chantal Ackerman, Siming Lang, Edward Yang. Those are names that you often see associated with slow cinema.
And I'm surprised that Terrence Malick isn't included in that list.
He could be. He could be. And if you're playing Movies 101 Bingo, mark off your card now because we mentioned Terrence Malick. But Lav Diaz's movies are also known for run times that I would say are quite intimidating. Some of his most famous movies include Norte, The End of History, The Woman Who Left, which you mentioned. Both of those are about 4 hours long. Magellan, meanwhile, is comparatively breezy at 164 minutes, which maybe makes it a good entry point into his films. And I just want to give a shout out to the Magic Lantern for booking Magellan in the first place, because this is the kind of movie that isn't going to sell out screenings, but it's a movie that's designed to envelop you. And that can really only happen in a movie theater. I'm really glad I saw this on a big screen.
You wouldn't want to see it on a small screen.
Yeah. And Diaz wants you to pay attention to how long he's holding his shots. And he often holds them for minutes at a time.
The very first scene, it seems like it took almost 10 minutes. And all it is a camera set on the front of a boat that is slowly approaching.
Which I guess you could see as dull, or you could see it as almost meditative, kind of zen-like in that way.
Well, it's definitely mystical.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he gives us images throughout Magellan that look almost like Renaissance oil paintings. I was thinking of Kubrick's Barry Lyndon all the way through it, where you're almost startled when something moves within the frame because it is so still. I love the sound design in this movie. It really comes alive in a theater. I mean, the water lapping at the shore, the wind blowing through the sails on these boats, the creaking of the ropes on the boats. And I also love the way that it deals with the poetry of nature, which, I mean, Malick did too. And I think the Malick film that this one, yeah, I know. Okay, mark your bingo card off again. Probably his film, The New World. So Magellan has all these beautiful shots of landscapes and just nature in general. But the image that really stuck in my mind comes near the end of the film when Magellan's men have gone through this village and gathered up all of the idols, the religious idols of these people, and they've thrown them into a pile and they're preparing to burn them. And the people in the village are just kind of looking on helplessly. And it's one of the most succinct and gutting images I've ever seen in terms of summing up what colonialism looks like. And I think ultimately that's what this movie is about. It takes a long time to get there, but that's in keeping with the journey that these characters are going on. And I think the last half hour, 45 minutes of Magellan are, I think, pretty remarkable. The first two thirds are remarkable too. I think, I know this isn't going to be for everybody, but I was enveloped in this movie. I was really pulled into it. Is it a patience tester? Sometimes, but I think it is deliberately so.
Word of warning to those who are historically and geographically challenged. And maybe that's just because I went to three different high schools and never had a world history course. But I had no idea where they were at any given point. I had really no idea about the backstory. So I would suggest that you do at least a minimal amount of reading before you go see this film. I think it would enhance your experience. At least you wouldn't have to wonder where these places were. Just saying that.
Although maybe the people in the movie, the navigators, I guess, I mean, maybe they don't even know where they're at certain points.
Yeah, that's true. But they at least were following some previously sure. established routes and so forth. And I also didn't really know anything about the backstory about how, Magellan got into ill favor with the Portuguese king and had to rely on the largesse of the Spanish king in order to mount this particular expedition. So I would say a little background reading could be helpful. We wanted to see this at the Palm Springs Film Festival, but because we didn't know if it would come here to Spokane, and we wanted to see it on the big screen. But because it has such a lengthy running time, it would have cut out options before and after. So again, a shout out to the Magic Lantern for being willing to, you know, forego maybe multiple screenings of other films in order to accommodate this. I would say a couple of things that people might want to be aware of. There is violence throughout this film, and understandably so. It's not gratuitous in any way. As a matter of fact, in some instances, Diaz creates these almost Renaissance paintings, you know, of, you know, what's happening.
Yeah, or he'll cut away from the violence and we watch people reacting to it.
Correct.
Instead,
and there are many scenes of beaches or countrysides filled with bodies that are dismembered in many cases.
But Nathan, I would agree with you that that scene where they destroyed so unnecessarily. I mean, there was this conversion to Catholicism that was an integral part of these explorations who came from Catholic countries. They'd get the, you know, sort of imprimatur, so to speak, of the Pope. They would get, you know, these Catholic kings who wanted to, you know, sort of buy their way into heaven and so forth. But when they destroyed those historical and religious artifacts, and the only thing that you really see is this woman, like, sobbing. I mean, that was just so, it was so cruel. And it was so telling, as you pointed out. And there were some scenes in this that I just thought were pretty mind-blowing. The only problem I had, and you, the two of you may disagree about Magellan, I'm not sure that Gael Garcia Bernal, who I like a lot, I'm not sure he was the ideal casting choice. I'm just putting that out there for possible discussion.
I'm not going to complain about looking at Gael Garcia Bernal.
I'm not either. Yeah. You know, I like Gael Garcia Bernal, and I think he's terrific in everything. And I think he's terrific in this movie, too, because whatever he might lack in stature, he gains in charisma. I mean, the guy owns the screen. So I thought he was absolutely fine.
His sort of inherent charisma, I think, is just right for the character of Magellan, because I think what Lav Diaz ultimately has to say, and I would also argue that the movie kind of ultimately isn't about Magellan.
No, it's not.
It's about the people on this island.
I agree.
Especially about his Tagalog interpreter or his Filipino interpreter that's on the boat. I think he kind of becomes the key figure. But I think what Lav Diaz has to say about Magellan is this is a guy that did kind of coast on his charisma on his way to wrap people around his little finger. And I don't think he really was about anything at all.
And he supposedly bogarted that quince so that he kind would of not backward. Get scurvy and everyone else
he
would
sort
be
of fell backward
subjected
into,
to it.
Into history. So I think there are some provocative things that are being said about this moment in history in the film.
I think you're right, except that ultimately I think the movie can be summed up in two words. Colonialism bad. So
it's more nuanced than that, even though the message is right. But there's more going on there, I think.
That was our discussion of writer-director Lav Diaz's film Magellan. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to check out Peter Hujar's Day and The Plague. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The 35th annual record sale is almost here. Join Spokane Public Radio this weekend at Center Place Regional Event Center. Browse thousands of records, CDs, and equipment ready to become part of your collection. Visit Center Place in Spokane Valley from 11 to 5 both days. Proceeds from the 35th annual record sale support SPR's trusted information and arts programming. Find details at SpokanePublicRadio.org.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I reviewed writer-director Lav Diaz's film Magellan. Let's now turn to a couple of movies that unfold in more current times. The first is Iris Sack's adaptation of the Linda Rosenkrantz interview titled Peter Hujar's Day, followed by writer-director Charlie Pollinger's feature The Plague. In his day, which lasted from the mid-1960s until his death at age 53 in 1987, Peter Hujar worked as a photographer in and around New York City. He was, in fact, one of the most assiduous chroniclers of the city's gay life, and he photographed and palled around with any number of his era's celebrities, from Allen Ginsberg to Fran Lebowitz. One day in December 1974, Hujar agreed to be interviewed by Linda Rosenkrantz, a writer most noted for her contributions to the genre of nonfiction fiction, as exemplified by her 1969 novel Talk. The theme was to be part of a collection of stories about what people did during a single day. Taking a transcribed copy of that interview, director Ira Sachs developed the feature Peter Hujar's Day, which stars Ben Whishaw as Hujar and Rebecca Hall as Rosenkrantz. Whether you find the film an intriguing portrayal of an artist or something akin to watching paint dry is likely to depend on your own personal tastes.
And I guess with that last statement, you have told us that you thought it was more like drying paint. Okay, so that's good because we like to have these spirited discussions sometimes. And I think that we should say from the beginning, or I'll say from the beginning, that Peter Hujar's Day is not a biopic in any respect, at least to my way of thinking. And it is a conversational film, but it's more of a monologue. And I'll return to that notion in a moment because of course, the great thing, or maybe the best thing, or the most notable thing about this film is that we have the wonderful Ben Whishaw as Hujar, because I don't know if this would have worked as well in his absence. Rebecca Hall plays Linda Rosenkrantz, and she does not have the opportunity as the interviewer to participate as actively, in this conversation. So I've seen some reviewers or some commentary basically comparing this to other talkie-type films, most notably My Dinner with Andre. But I don't think that that's an apt comparison because those are real conversations. And here we basically have a recital of what Peter has done over the course of his last day. But the way that Ben Whishaw delivers it I thought was really masterful in many respects, because he drops all these names of important people and he just does it, you know, as though, oh, it's so totally normal to see Allen Ginsberg. It's totally normal, you know, to see Fran Lebowitz. It's totally normal, you know, and in his world it was. And I thought that this did a good job of capturing that sort of era in New York City. I mean, I was living in New Jersey at the time, not the same, believe me, I know. But I could appreciate some of the, you know, you don't see a lot of New York City, but it had this, like, you know, sort of gritty vibe. And they were talking about the East Village and, oh, do we have to go over there? And then they were talking about, you know, going all the way over to 10th Avenue. And I just really appreciated many aspects of this. But apparently, some people would have rather, I guess, have gone to the Sherwin-Williams paint store.
It was for me. And I'm glad you brought up the notion of biopics and talking about Peter Hujar's day, because I almost saw this as a repudiation of all the conventions that we've come to associate with the great artist biopic. This movie doesn't have any real, like, historical signposts. It doesn't have these great emotional epiphanies. There are no highs, no lows. But as Peter Hujar is talking through the events of the previous day, we get a sense of who he is, how he looks at the world, how he fits into that art scene, how he thinks about his own work and some of the hangups he has about it, and those interactions that he has with these people that are much more well known than he is. We also get a sense of what they were actually like behind closed
especially
doors.
Especially Allen Ginsberg.
And, oh, and yeah. That whole section is
great.
Yeah,
that was great. And also, Peter Hujar talks about not getting paid. And, you know, that's an ongoing thing for people in the gig economy today. It's like waiting for your money, waiting for your money. Should I reach out? How do I handle
and
it?
And he's talking about all this infighting that's happening at the Village Voice. And I loved all that stuff. Of course, you're going to think about My Dinner with Andre. I was also thinking about a very strange movie called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, which was all these little snapshots about the Canadian classical pianist. I mean, it's a similarly kind of abstract way of dealing with an artist and who they are and what they were about.
Yeah. I was also thinking of the Before series.
Of course.
You know, well, I prefer those movies to this
well,
one.
Well, so do I. But this one's still good. And also, a bonus point, it's 70 minutes long. So
that's true.
Give it a chance. It's on the Criterion.
And Wish I is terrific. I will grant you that. Anyway, that was our discussion of Peter Hujar's day. Let's turn now to a film that could be described this way, a middle school water polo movie as imagined by the late William Golding. Golding, of course, was the author of Lord of the Flies, his 1954 novel about boys stranded on a desert island who devolve into murderous savagery. No murders occur in The Plague, written and directed by Charlie Polinger, but the film does feel like a more contemporary and, to a certain extent, believable version of Golding's tale. Set in 2003, The Plague stars Everett Blunk as Ben, a new kid attending a summer water polo camp who's confronted by the typical kind of middle school hazing that gradually becomes something ever more pernicious. Blunk is fine as Ben, but K.O. Martin is even better as a burgeoning sociopath, while Joel Edgerton as their clueless coach is his typical dependable self. Still, if your point is that surviving is just a matter of dancing until you drop, you have to wonder whether the effort to watch The Plague, despite some rather arresting visual effects, is remotely worth it.
Well, this is one of the most unsettling movies I've seen in a long while, and it's about how insecurity and pliability can become weaponized. And it was making me think all the way through. It was making me think about how modern horror movies often bend over backwards to be as disturbing and as sadistic as possible. This is a movie about a bunch of preteens being horrible to each other, and it's far more anxiety producing than anything
because
someone like
based on real
Ari
life.
Aster could dream up. And it sometimes even resembles a body horror film as this plague manifests itself in ways that are physical as well as emotional. And of course, adolescence can sometimes feel like a David Cronenberg movie. And I can speak, I think, with the most authority in this room as to the accuracy of the way that these kids talk and interact. I was also a teenager in 2003, and this movie, The Plague, made me realize that I do not need to revisit that time. There is a barbarism and a brutality in this movie, you know, despite the fact that, as you mentioned, Dan, there's not a lot of outward violence in the way that even describing it as a horror movie might make you think. It's emotional violence.
Emotional
it's psychic
violence. Absolutely.
There is real physical violence too. But and again, I think the performances of these kids are just, I think, incredible. Everett Blunk, Kyle Martin, and Kenny Rasmussen as the quote-unquote weird kid that everyone pushes
Eli.
Aside. Yeah, so I don't know if this is a pleasant watch or if I even enjoyed watching it, but man, Pollinger really has an eye.
Visually, it's an amazing movie.
Well, and Dan, you said you had similar experiences 45 years earlier.
Yeah, so this might be a timeless movie.
I don't know what's happening in 2026, but it seemed like it resonated for a group of boys across generations for sure.
But there was a moment in the movie in which it lost it for me. And at that point, I went, oh, please, you don't have to caricaturize. You don't have to exaggerate here. It's bad enough.
I kind of agree with you on that. Actually, I think I know what you're talking about without spoiling anything. Maybe it does go a little far when the dialogue and the relationships were potent enough.
I appreciated the fact, having gone to three different high schools, how it feels to be the new kid and you're trying to fit in, because he comes to this new school and he's going to water polo camp. You get the impression that maybe the summer before school starts. So he's trying to sort of gauge what's happening. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to be in with the in crowd, but he doesn't want to be out.
Right.
Ben's character is the one really believable aspect of the movie The Plague, simply because he wants to fit in. And yet he wants to be nice to the outcast also. And then he gets caught in between and he plays both sides, not because he necessarily wants to, but to survive. It's not necessarily a very likable movie to watch.
But also it's short. It was short. It was
that's
like 89 minutes.
Point.
So
yeah, and I think Pollinger is a filmmaker to watch out for. He this movie, actually, The Plague, won the DGA award for best first feature. And if nothing else, he knows how to frame a shot and use music and edit and really pull you into this
and
terrifying
world.
And it
was also featured at the Palm Springs International Film Festival.
There you go.
And
yeah.
People we know who had seen it before we did really appreciated it.
Yeah. So we were just talking about The Plague. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discuss the feature films Magellan and Peter Hujar's Day. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Till then, consider these words from the late, great science fiction author Ray Bradbury. I have never listened to anyone who criticized my taste in space travel, sideshows, or gorillas. When this occurs, I pack up my dinosaurs and leave the room. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.